Welcome to Filmstrip. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay.
And I'm Nick.
And this is our review of Prisoners, starring Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal, Viola Davis, Maria Bello, Terrence Howard, Paul Dano, David Deschmelchen, probably messed that up, and Melissa Leo, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Released in 2013 on a $46 million budget, grossed $122 million at the box office, garnered a lot of critical acclaim and some criticism. So we'll get into that as we go. But Nick, you picked this one, and it's one you've talked about to me offline for a while. So what's your fascination with Prisoners or the works of Denis Villeneuve?
Well, for me, it's mostly the director. I've saw one of his movies. I won't say which one, about, you know, a few years ago. And it was just the style, the direction that always was something that just was like, I watched it. I was just like, wow, it's like the music, the way, you know, the cinematography is and everything, you know, those are all individual contributors, but you know, the director's the one that kind of puts it all together. And, you know, he surrounded himself by some very, very talented, you know, cinematographers and everything throughout his career from what I've researched. And what I wanted to do was go back and kind of start with his first US title. I know he has about five or six movies before this, but I wanted to kind of concentrate on, you know, his US releases and kind of see, you know, kind of the evolution of his filmography, and to really just, you know, talk about, you know, he's got, you know, the new Dune movie coming out later this year, and just kind of talk about, you know, really, I think, you know, one of the, you know, most known auteurs right now that's working in Hollywood.
And yeah, he totally is. And I think you're right. I mean, he's a Canadian filmmaker, so he's had a number of other things before his big major releases started. But I've seen a few of his films, some of which I haven't seen. I mean, I had not seen this one before in its entirety. I think I'd seen pieces of it. I've seen Sicario. I've actually seen part of Arrival, but I have a funny story as to why I didn't finish that one. We'll maybe talk about that one another day. And then obviously Blade Runner 2049. And I am finally getting around to like, okay, I need to watch this new Dune movie. I am not necessarily a fan of the book. I've never tried to read it. I understand it's quite dense, and I do enough dense reading at work that just for fun, that doesn't sound like a good idea, but I understand visually it's like really a feast, and I know the new one's coming out. So yeah, we've done a director's retrospective before on Filmstrip, and we just kind of stretched that out over some time. Kurt and I spent, you know, a year or two going through Stanley Kubrick movies, and that was a fun exercise to just see if you could pick up on sort of the, you know, all of the nuances that a filmmaker builds throughout their time. I think, you know, John Jansen used to call it film grammar, right? Like back in the day on Hollywood Saloon and stuff. And Denis Villeneuve definitely has a film grammar, and, you know, he's done a lot of different genres, which I think is neat, but I do think thrillers and adult dramas and like tension are things that he delves in quite well, and he knows how to paint them with kind of those long brushes, like the way a good classical composer, somebody like, you know, Paganini, you know, who was known as the devil's, you know, fiddle or whatever, violinist, because he could just make things sound ominous from the most simple places. And I really am interested in looking at this. And like I say, this was a movie you had talked to me about a good bit, and I knew I'd seen part of it before, but it was probably like on HBO or something, and I didn't start it, and I just kind of caught about halfway into it, and I realized like that's probably something I want to watch later, and I just hadn't gone back to it. So this was one you definitely wanted to go back to. And I mean, we'll do the plot summary in a minute and the spoilers and stuff, but this, you know, plays on a lot of primal fears, and you're the parent of the two of us, so this is like the parent's worst nightmare right here when a kid goes missing.
Yeah, totally. I think I was telling you that offline. Is you know, there's been a couple, I think every parent has this, whether they admit it to it or not. There's always an instance where you take your eyes off your young child and you don't know where they are, even if it's just for a split second. And that feeling that you get, I mean, it's indescribable, but if you bring it up to any parent, they know exactly what you're talking about. It's just hard to describe. It's just like, it's panic, adrenaline, fear, you know, everything just all mixed into one. It's like, you actually feel like your heart just like kind of sink into your stomach. And it's just, then you go on like this, like, doesn't matter. I remember one time where years ago we were at a 4th of July parade, and my son, we had walked down to the liquor store, believe it or not, before the parade, and me, my father and him had walked back. Well, I went to go sit down in our chairs, and my father then went to the gas station, and I thought my son went with my father to the gas station, but no, he was actually behind me and he didn't realize I sat down in the chair. So he ended up walking all the way back down to the liquor store. Now, mind you, he's like 3 years old when this is going on. And the liquor store was a few blocks down. And I remember like all of a sudden looking behind me and my dad was coming back and I go, you know, where's Chase? And we realized he wasn't there. And like that whole thing hits you. And I went running down the street and there was a cop that was there. And I ended up like grabbing him by the arm, like my son's gone and everything. And then like, I just happened to look over and he was like 10 feet away from me at that point. But like, man, it was like the fact that I remember like every little detail about something that was, you know, roughly 12 years ago. I mean, just kind of shows you how it just sticks with you. So watching this movie and kind of seeing, you know, the extreme element of what it is, it's definitely something I think that all parents think of. And I think there's especially the masculine part about it as well, you know, with the fathers and what you would do to get your child back. And, you know, that's what this movie really delves into. It's something where I don't want to say like every parent is like, you know, fathers fantasized about it, because I think that's the wrong terminology, but it's something I think we've all figured, like, what would we do in that place? Like, what would we do if someone had hurt our child or someone had known where our child is? What would we do to them? You know what I mean? To be able to even have the chance of just getting them back or saving them or seeking revenge, you know? So it's definitely, it's a primal thing, I feel, but it's something I think that every parent, especially any father, knows. And I think that's why this movie kind of hit me a lot was, and we'll get into in the plot summaries about halfway through this movie about like what some of the characters do. And it's like seeing it from the outside. I mean, at first you're kind of like, okay, yeah, yeah. But then as it kind of goes on, you're like, oh crap, man. And, but you despise them, but yet understand them at the same time. It's very, very interesting dynamic.
Yeah. And just to double back on the story you were telling, you again, I'm not a parent or whatever, but I have vivid memories as a kid of getting lost somewhere. And like just sort of the panic I felt about that, because I grew up, you know, my parents used pop culture and television and movies to teach us a lot of things. I think I told a story a long time ago when we reviewed Fatal Attraction that was my parents' way to talk to us about, you know, this is why you don't get me messing around with the wrong people. It's twisted logic, right? But I remember seeing this movie that Walter Matthau was in called Without a Trace. And I don't even remember the TV movie or something like that, but it's about this kid that goes missing and he's like this private detective or something. And he just chases and goes after, and he finally finds the kid. And it's, I mean, he got abducted by like this old couple or something, and they weren't doing anything to him. They just took him because they were lonely. So anyway, he ends up returning them to the parents. But I remember my folks, you know, telling us, because we were latchkey kids, my brother and I, like, just be very, very careful who you walk up to and all that stuff. And I remember the first time they hired a college kid to come pick us up from school before my brother could drive. I didn't know they had done that. It just like slipped my mind or something. And so this girl pulls up in this car and I'm like, who are you? You know, and I had no idea who she was. And she had to go through like all this convincing me, like, no, I know who your mother is. It's okay. You know, and I got a laugh out of it years later, because I bumped into her several years later. She stayed in town and we laughed about that, but it is one of those things. And I think all I knew about this movie was that, oh, it's about kids that get kidnapped and stuff. And like, if you were to summarize this movie in one sentence and say that, I think you're really missing a lot of what's going on here. Cause this movie's about so much more than that. Like it's 2.5 hours. And when I saw that runtime, I thought, man, that's a long way like to stretch that story out. But then when I got into it and watched it, I realized like, oh man, this movie's got a lot more going on in it. And it actually reminded me of a couple of other things from different genres that maybe I'll bring up as we get into the thing. But I was really impressed with just the dense plot that is in when it is a very simple story, but there's a lot that they want to do and go on here. And I was just really impressed by it. And again, it's one of those things that I think it's a simple way to describe it, but calling this movie a slow burn is a good way to describe it to somebody that's maybe never seen it before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And even the title Prisoners, I mean, you can sit there and take it at all face value that it's like, oh, Prisoners, about the two little girls that are, you know, kidnapped, maybe, you know, taken prisoner per se, but it's really about people being prisoners of them own selves. You know what I mean? Whether it's prisoners of anger, prisoners of alcoholism, prisoners mm-hmm. of, you know, your childhood and the trauma and everything like that. It's more about, you know, being a prisoner within yourself. So, but we'll get into it. So probably good time to jump onto the plot, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let me jump into that. And I'll try to go pretty detailed on this one, because this movie again is really long. So we'll blow as much of it as we can here, and then we'll just kind of step around it and talk about all the stuff that happens, because there's a lot of twists and turns in this one. So spoilers hot, you know, if you haven't seen it, I'm about to, you know, ruin it for you. So pause and come back if you want to watch the movie first. The Dovers and the Burges are middle-class families in Conyers, Pennsylvania, and their families celebrate Thanksgiving together. And this Thanksgiving becomes every parent's worst nightmare when the two youngest girls from each family, Anna and Joy, go missing after they were seen playing near a rundown RV parked in the neighborhood. Enter Detective Loki, who is adept at running down leads and solving cases to an obsessive point. And he and the police converge on the RV, but the driver crashes the vehicle, attempting to evade them. However, as the police question him, the young man with diminished capacities named Alex, they can't find any forensic evidence to tie him to the abduction, and they have to set him free to the care of his Aunt Holly. Keller Dover decides to take matters into his own hands and abducts Alex and imprisons him in an abandoned property that his father left him. And with the reluctant help of his friend Franklin, they torture and harass Alex, trying to learn the location of their girls. Detective Loki continues to run down leads and even finds a decomposed body in the basement of a priest who claims he killed the man because he confessed to murdering children, but Loki doesn't buy it. Meanwhile, Dover continues to become unhinged, isolating himself from his family, relapsing into his alcoholism, and ramping up the tactics on Alex to the point that he imprisons him in basically a wall shower, and where it's either freezing water or scalding hot at all times. Loki notices a strange man lingering at a vigil for the girls one night and eventually traces him to his house, where he discovers boxes of snakes and children's clothes stained with blood. The man, Bob Taylor, struggles with police during an interrogation while he's drawing mazes, and he continually will not answer their questions. And ultimately, he gets a gun and he shoots himself with it. The Burches and Keller identify photos of bloody clothing belonging to their girls, but Keller refuses to give up hope and goes to visit Alex's Aunt Holly while evading Detective Loki, who's grown suspicious of him. Joy, in the meanwhile, manages to escape and is under care in the hospital, but can't provide really any information on where Anna is located. Loki and the police eventually find Alex and rescue him, which sends Keller on the run. He goes back to Aunt Holly, hoping to get more answers, only to have her turn the tables on him. Holly, you see, was the ultimate kidnapper, along with her husband, the decomposed body that Loki found earlier. And she injures him, drugs him, and throws him in a hole where they used to stash children they've abducted through the years. They did so to wage their own war on God after their child died. Keller finds a whistle identical to the one he gave his daughter, or maybe it is his daughter's, we'll talk about that, when she was out in the neighborhood in case she needed help. He clutches it as he prays for his daughter's life and prepares to die. Alex and Bob were the first two children, and they survived, but both were severely damaged from that experience. Detective Loki arrives to tell Holly the news about Alex, but she's nowhere to be found, and when he enters the house, he sees a picture of that husband wearing the maze necklace identical to the corpse he found earlier, and he knows it's her. So he finds her in the middle of giving Anna a lethal injection and is injured in a shootout where he kills her. Running on adrenaline, Loki drives Anna to the hospital, where she is saved and he is treated for his injuries. Keller Dover is assumed to have fled and evaded prosecution for his imprisonment of Alex. And Loki visits the crime scene, where investigators have left mid-discovery due to the ground being frozen. And as he prepares to walk away, he hears the faint sound of a whistle in the distance, and credits roll. And that's the most detailed plot summary I can give us. I think I've gone through all the big points. There's a lot to unpack in this movie. And yeah. Nick, I want to
talk outside of TerrorVision. That is probably the most detailed plot summary we've ever had. So
there have been so many episodes since TerrorVision.
I know, you know that one still rings.
That is your favorite one, that's for sure. And people can dig way back in the archives for that. I mean, probably it is Nick's best plot summary, no doubt about that. But we get into this, and I want us to do things as we go through these things, obviously, to talk about stuff that the director did. But you mentioned something before to the plot summary there, and I want to mention this now, that I feel like the interesting part about this movie to me is that the climax of it doesn't happen at the point where you think it actually does. You know, like the tension of this movie really runs hard for the first act. And then the second act becomes this smolder of just frustration and anger and misdirection and all this quiet sort of lurking about, you know, and stuff like that. And then the third act just hits the gas. And I'm trying to think of another movie that does that. And I'll tell you one I came up with was the 1960 Alfred Hitchcock Psycho. Like, you could argue that movie climaxes at the shower scene, which is the end of the first act. And then it does this kind of slow boiler for a minute. And then it's on like adrenaline for 25 minutes at the end. And I don't know. I was thinking you could think of any other movies in this genre, in this thriller genre, that do that kind of thing. Because it's been a while since I've seen one that pulled it off as adeptly as this one does.
No, I think Psycho is probably the best example of that, because that's very true. I mean, we watched that movie. I mean, that first act is almost his own movie in itself. I mean, you could have done that as a short movie, and that's could have been what it is. But then, yeah, you get the second act, which is almost like the first act of a new movie. And then, you know, then you get into the climax there. So I think that's definitely a good call. One I probably would have brought on myself.
Yeah. I mean, I have another one too, and I'll save it for the ending, because it'll tie into my ultimate thoughts, and I don't want to give those away yet. But I want to start by just talking about the absolute stacked cast that Denis Villeneuve put together for this thing. I mean, if you only know Hugh Jackman from Wolverine, you have missed the talent that this man has. Like, he is such a versatile actor and is apparently really well liked by everybody that's ever met him. But Jake Gyllenhaal is one of his generation's best performers. Like, he can just disappear in roles. And then you surround them with, you know, Viola Davis and Maria Bello, and then Paul Dano's really coming to be a great actor and done a lot of stuff. Melissa Leo is fantastic. Even David Dasmalchian, who you probably only know is the one of the crazy Mr. X in Dark Knight. You know, maybe that's where most people know him. He's an accomplished theater performer. And then even like Terrence Howard, who I don't necessarily think is a great actor, but can give good performances in The Right Thing. It's a really well-rounded cast. And that's not even mentioning like some of the other people that just pop in and out of this thing. It's really loaded. And I'm trying to think of the last time I saw a movie that had this many like names or people in it where they just all command something when they're on the screen.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, when you talk about some of the, movies that really have a cast like this, I mean, I think this one's just, it's good as far as just each actor in here is really, really playing to their strengths a lot when it comes to that. And it's really well brought together. But the one I actually said I was really surprised was Terrence Howard, because it's a very different performance from him. I mean, I can't sit there and say I've seen every Terrence Howard movie. I mean, I think most of my stuff is kind of limited to the Iron Man's, you know, before he ran his mouth, you know, and stuff like that. But he very, very subdued, very like meek character, which was not what I normally see from him in movies that I've seen. But the one that I was actually most surprised with is actually Jake Gyllenhaal. I've, you know, kind of the same thing with Terrence Howard, is I know him from his more mainstream movies. And before, like, you know, I've always kind of like, you know, like even like in Spider-Man, I'm like, he's kind of a fun actor and stuff like that. But then it's like, I saw him in here and I was like, actually really was impressed with the depths that he went to with his character. Like, even this, like the little, like, you know, the hand shaking and things like that, he's got like these little ticks and stuff that keep going off. And I was like, you know, that's a, you know, the way that he brought the character to life and everything. And the fact that, like, you can see, like, there's a reason why he's so like obsessed with like missing kids and everything, and why he's good with it. Cause he can kind of figure out some of the trauma that he probably endured when he was a child and how he brought it forth. So, you know, the tattoos on the neck and everything, I think he even had tattoos on his knuckle, which would signify that, you know, this probably wasn't his original career choice, and you know, kind of how he got into it. But also Hugh Jackman. I mean, mm-hmm. I've seen him in a lot of stuff. I think this one probably reminds me most of The Prestige. As far,
yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah, just the way his, you know, his performance is. And, you know, yeah, you see him from Wolverine, you think like, you know, good actor, but, you know, mostly like, I don't want to say like Arnold, where it's kind of like, you know, the physicality, you know, I mean, the muscles and everything like that. But yeah, roles like this are really where I think he tends to shine. And, you know, playing this alcoholic father, I mean, he's believable. And both him and, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal and Terrence Howard, for the most part, it's like, you know, these actors, but you can tell they do a great job when you know them, but you believe who they are. It's not like something where, you know, Tom Hanks, for instance, I see so many characters where he plays, or Tom Cruise, where I'm like, well, that's Tom Cruise playing a character. These are more like, these are characters that happen to be played by them.
Yeah, they kind of disappear into it. There used to be the term for like character actors, that guys that would disappear, but these people can all lead a movie too. They all have at one time or another, but they still possess that ability as performers to bleed into it. And I mean, I think you go back to Gyllenhaal, like Donnie Darko is sort of like his big breakout role and stuff. And if you see that, like, you see shades of that throughout everything he does, even something like Nightcrawler. And, you know, you get away from, you know, his big, you know, superhero movies and, or, you know, big budget action things that he's done and stuff like that. And there's nothing wrong with those, but like, go watch something like End of Watch that he did once, which is a really like, it's a found footage police movie, which is an interesting way of doing that, but it's really good. And he's really good at it. And he's gives a real heartbreaking performance, but I've always liked him. And even in like sort of like Brokeback Mountain, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, he's got such range and can do these things. And when I was watching him here, man, it just in my head, I kept going, this is what the Vincent Hanna Al Pacino character in Heat probably was like when he was younger. You know, like if they ever made a prequel to Heat, and I think there's a book that is now or something like that, I'm like, please cast Jake Gyllenhaal in the Hanna role. Like, I think he could pull that off, because not to do like the crazy, you know, stuff that Pacino does in parts of that movie, but I think he could do the smoldering kind of very smart, always looking around the room, always picking something up, you know, and that's the cool thing about Loki is that at times we get to watch him go totally unhinged, you know, where he just loses his mind. He gets mad at the suspect. He wrecks his desk or whatever. But anytime he's with somebody else, like, you know, Dover in particular, he's always calm and he's cool and he's collected. And he's just, it's neat to watch somebody that can operate between those two vacillations, you know?
Oh, totally. And I think that actually adds more to his character too. Cause you can tell, like, based upon that, obviously the flip of a switch, you know, kind of the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde that his character has there, you know, you could probably tell, like, you know, there's some traumatic stuff in his childhood where, you know, where he's with, you know, the parents and he's doing his job out in public. I mean, he's definitely putting on one persona, but then when he's more frustrated or comfortable, you know, then another side of him comes out, which is, you know, it's very human. You know, we're all not one personality at all time. We have different, you know, we're gradients of stuff. And I, you know, some people are more, have more of a gradient than others, but it's definitely one of these things where it's definitely a full performance.
Yeah. I mean, and even his name, Loki, you know, the God of mischief and all that stuff. And you have to kind of set aside everything that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has maybe taught you about that. If you just know the story, that's not, you know, done by accident. I mean, the guy that wrote the script did that on purpose. And he plays in both these worlds. I mean, he does talk about having a past and growing up in a boy's home. And you look at his tattoos and all of his stuff, man, like he's got like a pentagram going and a upside down cross and then like a right side Celtic cross. And then he's got like a Mason's ring on, and I'm like, this dude's like tried every religion in the world, you know, probably Scientology too, since Gyllenhaal is a Scientologist. And you can just sort of imagine, like, this guy just bounced from thing to thing trying to find his place in the world. And ultimately what we realize is that his place is in the shadows, chasing down the monsters of the world, which is, I mean, a hell of an existence to try to wrestle with, but he does a good job with it.
Well, I think the tattoo signified that maybe at a time he saw himself as the monster.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like when you think about that, it's like the tattoos and the different representations of it typically might be something of a contrarian. You know what I mean? Someone who's purposely trying to be different, trying to like provoke a negative response from people. And it's like, maybe, you know, he struck me as someone that would be like that, where it's like, you know, he saw himself as a monster, wanted to be the villain, wanted to be the bad guy, but suddenly realized that, you know what, there's worse people out there than him, where his is more of a facade to protect himself, you know, kind of that shield you'd put up, where it's like,
yeah,
you know, hey, I'm not a bad guy, but I'll put the tattoos on me to make people think that. But he probably came around and realized that, you know what, I'm pretending to be a monster when there's actually monsters out there. So maybe I'm better served trying to hunt them down.
Well, and I mean, like you talk about, it's that old line from Nietzsche, you know, you stare into the abyss long enough and it starts staring back at you, you know, and what you realize, what that is signifying is that if you spend enough time in the darkness, you become accustomed to it. And then you have a choice to either be on its side or to be its adversary and know it that way. But there's a cost to that, you know, and there's a cost to Loki throughout this whole movie with that. And it's a good way to sort of bridge and to transfer into, you know, we don't meet him until a little bit into the movie. We meet these families first, and I got to tell you, man, like Hugh Jackman, again, he's talking about just a range of a guy. I mean, he can play a guy who has a steel skeleton and is, you know, just flying 50 feet in the air with claws, or he can play a dancer in a circus, or he can play a cloning magician, or all these different things, right? And then he could just play like a middle-class carpenter who's just trying to keep the mortgage paid and can't afford to help his son buy the used car, you know, and he's talking about that going over to their neighbors, you know, for Thanksgiving. And he just slips into so many things, and I gravitate toward him so much in this role, not because I relate to it, but he just seems like the kind of person that, like, you could just sit and just have a conversation with. Like, he would just be, you see this guy in town, you're like, hey, how's it going, Keller? You know, what's up? And like, you just know this guy. He was your buddy in high school, and he hung around, and that's probably his high school sweetheart. And they, you know, they work hard and they just make it work, you know? And I don't know. I really liked him, and I liked the way that he and Maria Bello and even Viola Davis and Terrence Howard and the kids too, all the, you know, they've got the teenagers and they've got younger kids and stuff too, the way that they all felt so lived in. And it's like 3 minutes of the movie. Like, they don't spend any time setting it up. They just drop us right in their living room. And it's like, you've been there for 10 years.
Oh, totally. He strikes me as a guy that, you know, you know, it kind of in a blue collar job, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm, totally
co-workers or something like that. But what struck me about him is like, you can just see like a sense of sadness on his face. You know what I mean? It's like, for all intents and purposes, they live a pretty good life, but I think for him, there's a lot of baggage there. I mean, obviously the former alcoholism that he refers to, but I think also, and I think this kind of gets into a little bit later here, is there's obviously issues with his father.
And oh, yeah.
His upbringing, yeah, and everything. I mean, hence the house later that was his father's, that was in ruin, that he never wanted to fix, probably a representation of the relationship. And, but then also the actions that he does as a father. You know what I mean? Where, you know, probably someone who felt let down by his father. And then suddenly, you know, he's now put in a position where he feels he let his kid down. The things that he would do now to just, you know, that he's trying to fix it, going to desperate lengths to try to fix it.
Well, I mean, think about the way they set up his whole personality. See, in the opening scene is him and his son hunting, deer hunting. And he's teaching his son to do this. He said, because son, when everything collapses and it goes down, there's not going to be anybody bring you the food. You're going to have to get it yourself. You're going to have to provide for your family. You know, you're going to have to know how to do these things. And I want you to learn how to do this. We don't kill just to kill. We're going to cut this thing up. We're going to use every bit of it we can. And I mean, it's good conservation. It's a good lesson, you know, if that's your bend and lifestyle. But I think that gives you so much insight as he's pouring all of this knowledge into his teenage son, who's, you know, like 15 or so, maybe 16, maybe at this point. And he's trying to get him to be a man and all this, while he's also got this young daughter that, you know, that's mom's job, and I'll, you know, deal with her when she gets a little older. I need you to be the protector. And then, you know, you talk about all this stuff they reveal about him throughout the time. He's, I mean, like the colloquial term these days, we call him a prepper, right? Like, he's got like MRE stacked up and like, you know, cases of water and, you know, just stuff that you would need to survive and kind of make your own homestead if you had to. And so there's something about him that no matter what happens in his life, he's never going to lose the distrust he has for the world around him. And it does go back to his father. We find out later his father committed suicide when he was a teenager, and you can tell that affected him in a very specific way, and that he has built the rest of his life as a protection against the absolute worst thing that could happen. And then the worst thing that could happen that he hadn't thought of happens.
Well, you think about a survivalist or a prepper, if you want to call it that, and what's the core foundation of it? They don't trust the system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Society. You know, it's this is all a facade. It's bound to collapse. And all these idiots that sit around here and put their faith into it are gonna be the first ones that are up the slaughter. I'm not gonna be like that. And you figure, you know, okay, his father committed suicide. Well, what is the biggest systematic thing you have as a child? It's your parents. They're the normalcy that you have. They are the ones that are, you know, you see in the morning, you see in the night when you go to bed, the ones that bring, you know, that they have dinner with, everything like that. So if your parent kills themselves, you know, I can imagine that, you know, it's such a tragic thing that, you know, that child himself would, the systematic beliefs that they had are destroyed.
Yeah, and, completely.
Yeah. And that's, you know, what you get there. But also you can see him taking the effort with his son, something that, you know, again, we get in with the daughter as well, as, you know, he's not going to abandon them, such as, you know, many people who have dealt with, you know, suicides and, the, you know, whatever, we'll see that person as abandoning them. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
that's kind of like the whole thing. That's, you know, like I said, it's a very, very, very dense character when you really kind of take a look at like everything around him and all these other stuff. I mean, him being a survivalist and everything like that, you know, kind of adds a little bit to the plot here and there with some, like, you know, set pieces and, ooh, what was he doing with that chemical or something. But really, when you start looking at, as far as a character, you know, evaluation of him, it's just really deep.
Yeah, it is. And like I say, it's a contrast to the Birches, and which is Terrence Howard is, I think he's like the music teacher, band director or something like that at the local school. I think his wife may be a teacher too. You got, I mean, Viola Davis is a powerhouse performer at any time, right? But you've got them they're obviously have been friends for years and years. They, you know, they're basically down the street from each other. They do holidays together. I mean, they're very close, right? And, but they're such different people. But I always think that's neat to see in a movie, because so many times in movies, like the friend group is like all homogeneous, you know, like they're all kind of the same thing. And in real life, like, I'm not friends with people like me. I'm friends with people that are different than me. That's why I'm friends with them, because it's interesting. It's, I don't want to talk to me. I have to live in my own head all the time. I want to talk to somebody different, right? And yeah, that's what makes this interesting, to see them together and to see them again in just those like family moments where they're just screwing around in the living room, and they're kind of, you know, they're making fun of him trying to play the trumpet and play Jingle Bells or something like that, and you know, they're and all this stuff. I really thought it was neat. It's a different contrast too, because like, let's say Terrence Howard is much more meek and kind of soft, and I don't mean soft in like a weak way, but like he's not a rough and tumble guy. He doesn't work in a rough and tumble type business or a business that is necessarily physically demanding on him, right? Like he works and he's a teacher, he's a classroom, and that is a mental exercise more than a physical one. So while he and Keller are friends, they work in opposite ways and they operate in different ways. And it was neat to watch Terrence Howard, because he's probably the character we get the least of stuff on, but I think that's on purpose. I think if we had one more person to try to have to follow, it would be too much. And the fact that he's just, you see why they're friends, because it's probably what keeps Keller sort of grounded and down sometimes. And then he's also like, Keller sort of his macho friend that kind of gets him to butch up and stuff sometimes.
You ever do something like you ever do wine tasting, Jay? You
know? I have, yes.
I know you have. Okay.
Yeah.
But saltine cracker, a lot of times is they'll give you with wine tasting, is something to kind of cleanse your palate. You know, that way, you know, next tasting that you do, you'd be able to get all the flavors and everything like that. And I think that's kind of the representation of Terrence Howard's character, is that if you didn't have a character like him, you got such extremes between, you know, Loki and, you know, all these other characters here, where he is kind of your sense of normalcy. He's the one that kind of brings you back to it. You know, it's like, you ever seen the movie The Fighter? You know, you know, with Mark Wahlberg and everything like that. You know, I always heard some criticism about it, where it's like, oh, Christian Bale's so great, all the sisters are great, but then Mark Wahlberg's kind of a milquetoast. But I'm like, well, that was the point. Is, and I'll get, it's based on a true story, but also the way the character is written, is you need that kind of reset of a character. Otherwise it can get too crazy too quick, as far as just, you know what I mean? I think.
Yeah. Like people can be too big. Like I'll go back to my Psycho reference. People talk about the Sam Loomis character. John Gavin was the actor that played him. And people talk about like, he's just kind of a bland, you know, 50s and 60s man or whatever. And I was like, I kind of think that's missing the point. He's supposed to just be an everyday guy from that period. Like, he's just, you know, when they recast it in when Gus Van Sant did it with Viggo Mortensen, I was like, that's the wrong move, because Viggo is not low key in any possible way, at least not in that movie. But the original one was, and he's supposed to be the blank. And I think you've hit it. Franklin is supposed to be really the audience in this point. Like the more people are probably like him than are like Keller in the way that they operate, even though people may want to do what Keller ultimately does, and very few are like Loki, you know, because he is the monster chaser. There can only be a couple of Van Helsings, you know, not everybody's going to be that, right?
And yeah, so and I think all three characters will kind of represent different, you know, way people would view themselves. You know, Loki's the one that's trying to fix the problem, and you know, you look at you know, Hugh Jackman's character, where he is the one that's kind of creating a problem. And then you got, you know, Terrence Howard's character, where it's essentially like probably where everybody more or less is at. You know,
Terrence Howard's trying to be the referee in this situation, even though he's not directly connecting to Loki with what's going on with Dover's character, but he's the one trying to go, man, we can't do this. This is wrong. He's the one that confesses to his wife and brings her in on it once they've kidnapped Alex and all that stuff. And so, I mean, he's the one that will not go beyond that. There's a line, and he's going to cross it a little bit, but he's not going to totally cross it. He can't do it. He can't bring himself to it. Whereas Keller Dover has a lot of demons in him, and he's really worked hard to lock them up. And it, you know, it's this terrible situation brings them out for him. And you see him really melt down. And instead of going unhinged, what Franklin does is he just completely emotionally crushes, you know. And I don't know, it was just neat to watch the dichotomy of them. You can even imagine it And something like watching a good play, you know, where you just see the characters just sort of melt across each other and stuff, and that there's such a good balance to each other. Because when you do a big character drama, man, everybody can't be like big or small all at the same time, or else it you can't tell anybody apart, right? And that's the point of this, is that there's got to be the yin and the yang, and then even maybe the triad part, the third part of it, to make it work. And I just thought it was really well done. But the point I wanted to end that on was that I love how Denis Villeneuve drops us into this family and we get to know them immediately. And then, I mean, there's like 2 minutes later and we're already in like danger, Will Robinson. You know, like I think everybody my age, your age, and maybe even beyond, you see a strange car in the neighborhood, don't run toward it. And every small kid in the world is going to, because as a kid, you just are curious, you know, and you see these things and like, you just know, like, oh, that looks like the kind of van you get in to disappear in, right? And I just such a great piece of cinematography by Roger Deakins, and also just great production design, because this is all in Denis' head. Like everybody was on this movie talked about, like, man, he had it laid out. Every raindrop was accounted for in some way. And it's so well set up when you see this kid's playing on that thing. And then all of a sudden they're going to go and look for the toy whistle, which seems like a throwaway thing. And then we realize later how important it is, but then they're gone and oh man. And then the panic hits.
Yeah, totally, totally. And that's it from there, like you said, you know, it really, really takes off. And then, you know, they're freaking out about the kids. The older siblings knew that there was the RV in the neighborhood. And, you know, like you said, God, you see that, you know, you stay the hell away, call the cops. But then they happen to, you know, they find it. And it's, you know, this standoff. And the actions of what happens there, it's like, you know, you see them, they're getting closer, you're closer. It's like, oh, you know, they're going to shoot the guy. And then also it's going to be a dead lead. Is the guy going to try to get away? And what does he do? He ends up crashing the RV, he goes, backs it up and then rams it forward. You know, I don't know if it's a desperate, you know, attempt to try to kill himself, or just because the guy was obviously, you know, he's not mentally, you know, all there, but definitely kind of leads you into a whole new situation where it's like, what the hell is going on here? And then you get into the interrogation with this guy.
Oh yeah. And look, we got to call out Paul Dano here. He will tell and has told, this was not a part I wanted. He said, this was not a headspace I wanted to get into. He said, but I just couldn't turn it down, man, with everybody that was involved and stuff. And he said, I had to do it. So it, like his whole like physical performance where he's kind of leering to one side or another, he said, I just came up with that so that I could get in and out of character and kind of just get away from that when I needed to. And I could just be me. And then I could go be Alex, because he's one of those kind of actors. And I mean, that's a heck of a method. And I've known enough actors to know, like, when you get like a really juicy role, it can be cool, but it can also hurt. Like, you have to like learn how to manage yourself psychologically to do that. And the way that it's introduced, that we meet Loki, he's eating Thanksgiving dinner at a Chinese restaurant by himself, and he's trying to flirt with the waitress, and she's having none of it, right? So the poor guy's just, you just don't know what he's doing, right? And then he takes the call, because why not, he's right there. And this whole RV thing goes down, and what you realize is that you have two loners that are about to go at each other in an interrogation scene. And the way he's got him backed up on the wall, man, Jake Gyllenhaal says, that is not me making that up. He said, I know a lot of cops. I've seen a lot of cops. I've talked to a lot of detectives, and they told me there are things that you can do that people don't like to hear about, but this is one of the tactics to interrogate somebody that's holding back on you. And I thought, man, what an intimidating presence.
And the thing that's interesting about the Alex character, and I don't know if this is maybe the thoughts that you were going through your head, was, is he making this up? Like, this whole, like, being, you know...
He doing Edward Norton in Primal Fear? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, the mental disability and stuff like that. Is this something that he's putting on? Is he just this liar that's in this character? And, you know, that's what was kind of going through my head, especially when they started bringing up the driver's license. Because they were like, how does this guy have a driver's license? Like, there's no way with this mental capacity that this guy would be able to get a driver's license and be able to go around and do this. And it was like, you sit there and you're thinking, like, yeah, that's true. Like, how does he have a driver's license? And the movie's bringing it up, like, really kind of throwing your face. And so, and then even when later, when, you know, he kind of gives some weird eye movements and everything like that. And even when he, you know, talks to, you know, Keller and everything, when the parking lot scene happens, it just kind of leaves you guessing, like, what is the story of this guy? Is this all up front? Is this a character? Is this just even like The Prestige? You remember that, where they showed you, like, you know, that you have to, if you're going to be this character, you have to be it all the time. Is it something like that? You know,
yeah. So
definitely it was interesting. And like, it's always kind of fun to kind of go back and then kind of realize like, oh, okay, well, the driver license thing makes sense when you realize that this guy never even had an identity. This was just a shared identity that the other kids had.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why he had the license, because the guy later in the movie that kills himself was probably the one that got the license, because he was one of these kids as well. And that's why the license exists. And that's why he's driving around.
Yeah. And they don't look all that dissimilar from one another, that you could have pulled that off. You know, like, you can kind of see, you know, if you take the glasses off and do the hair differently, it's, they're not, they're both kind of tall, lanky guys, you know. And you know, the thing about the Alex character is, when you first meet him and we realize, we're like, he fits the stereotype of all of everybody who's watched enough 2020 and true crime and all that stuff for the last 10, 15 years in culture, right? Like, oh yeah, that's the dude. Like, obviously, right? You know, creepy van, creepy person, you know, he's all of these things, right? And he is, but he's also the perfect, like, this is why you can't stereotype people, and you got to get to the bottom of it. And because he's ultimately, Alex is a victim as much as any other kid in this story and in this movie. And he becomes an even more of a victim because of what happens to him at the hands of Keller. And it makes you reevaluate the, when you go back and watch it again, you watch this movie a second time after seeing it, and you when you know everything, and it's like, oh man, it's like really sad to watch. And you're like, what happened to this kid? And you just start thinking about, he got taken, and they tell some throwaway line Melissa Leo drops about, like, my husband used to handle snakes and he had an accident with him. He's like, he probably got bitten by like a snake on his face or something when he was a little kid, and it just traumatized him, you know, and maybe he got some poison from it or something. You never know. And you don't know why he is the way he is, but you just know that he is. And like you say, the first inclination is, oh, he's faking this. But then you come to realize, like, no, he's really not. Like, he really doesn't know anything else. And when he gets abducted by Keller, that is one of the most frightening moments in this movie. Like, it was really scary, though, because I thought Hugh Jackman was just going to shoot him on the street at that point, right? Because he's been let go by the police. They don't have enough to keep him and all the stuff. And Hugh Jackman's just going to take it in his own hands. And I'm like, man, what is he going to do with this dude? And what he does with him, Nick, is some of the most violent stuff I've seen in a movie in a long time. Like, it is right up there with some of the most realistic violence I've seen in the film, the way he pummels this guy's face in.
Totally. And it's, even with like Alex and Keller, they're almost kind of similar in a way, because, you know, we learn, you know, when Alex is being, you know, in the parking lot, Keller grabs him and stuff. And he's like, you know, what did you do with my daughter? Where is she and stuff? And then he says, like, you know, they didn't cry until I left. So it's like, you know, as the audience, like, he's knows something. He's a part of it. And he was part of it. You know what I mean? He brought those children to his aunt, you know, aunt in quotation marks. So it's like, okay, well, you know, he did something wrong there, but it's like, then you go into the whole like traumatic stuff, and it's like, but you're like, you understand it. You don't justify it, but you understand it.
Yeah, he's just bait. Yeah. He's just being used, you know? Yeah,
exactly. And then you also then have Keller, where it's like, again, it's like, you're not justifying what he's doing, but you also understand it. You know what I mean? It's like, you're the insanity that would go over you as a parent, knowing that this person, who 99% of the public would believe, like, he did something, he knows more than what he's doing, especially after he said that in the parking lot. It's like, again, you're not justifying what he's doing, but you completely understand where his mindset's at. And he's doing that. And then it just gets a little bit more until, like, suddenly then he's in a freaking hot and cold box shower.
I mean, it's like Guantanamo. Like, it's everything you've ever heard about in enhanced interrogation techniques, you know, is what's going on there. And what I like about this is, in the moments when Keller is trying to work with the police, or he's trying to trust the system, the police are doing exactly what the police do. Like, it's very real. Like, I need you to calm down. What did he say again? Okay, let me go run that down. You know, it takes time to investigate a crime.
You got to let them go, because you want to go see what they're going to do.
Right. Yeah. And that's the, you know, that's one of the things, as you find out about the department's incompetence here sometimes, is that, you know, I don't have the budget to put somebody on him. Well, what else are we doing around here? You know, it's not like this is, you know, Philadelphia where we got a ton of, you know, crime going on. This is a suburb, man. Like, you know, like that. And I love how Loki sort of throws that in his captain's face and his captain ultimately throws it back at him later on. But they have the relationship to know, like, they're hamstrung by their resources, right? And it is a frustrating thing. You think like, oh, yeah, the cops just go investigate anything. No, they have a budget just like everybody else. They have to operate within that, you know, that sphere. And if they don't, then something's wrong. And I don't know, man. I thought it was neat to watch. You see the frustration just boiling over in Hugh Jackman's performance, right? And it doesn't justify what he does, because what he does is wrong. Let's just call it. But you get it, right? Like, I understand why he feels like this is my only recourse. And it's really what he says to Franklin. He's like, we don't have any other choice. I know he knows we've got to figure it out.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, even if it's a 1% chance, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to, probably as a parent, you're going to take that 1% chance. And especially when you're sitting there realizing that the bureaucracy of the police let someone who you were positive had something to do with them go. And while I said, like, yeah, you know, sometimes you're going to let these people go because, you know, give them enough rope to hang themselves with, right? But when you got two little girls' lives on the line, you know, they don't have time for this. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you could still be alive. They could be locked up somewhere and they could not have food or water. And, you know, this could happen, or they could be with someone else. Like, we can't play games here. So again, it's like, yeah, you completely, you know, you get what he's doing. And at first, you know, I'm on board, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, freaking grab this guy. Let's see if we can, you know, break a couple fingers and get him to talk. But, you know, he's doing it more and more and more and more. And then suddenly you're just like, you start questioning yourself. Cause I think I don't know where you were at first, but like I said, at first I'm kind of like, okay, let's see if the guy will talk. But then it's further you go in and you're like, man, this guy probably doesn't know anything. And that's always one of the things they talk about with torture, is like, eventually just going to get people to admit to something just to get you to stop.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's famous cases about where people have just been browbeaten for so long, they finally just start admitting to everything. Right. And, you know, it takes forever to unravel that and the legal system the way it is. I'll tell you what I think is the best scene of all of the interrogation stuff is when Hugh Jackman grabs that hammer. And you're like, man, is he really going to do this? You know, he puts his hand on that sink or whatever, and you can tell it's the only time he really pulls restraint back. He just smashes the hell out of that sink and buries the hammer in the wall and lets, you know, Alex crumple before him. And I don't know, man. Like, at first I was like, he's going to do it, but he just can't bring himself to do it, because I think somewhere in the back of his mind, it started to weigh on him. This guy doesn't know what I want him to know, but I need him to know. So I'm just going to keep on, because I've started this and now I can't stop.
Yeah. And I think that's what it is. I think I took it at that moment that he realized that, oh fuck, I've completely, like, yeah, like this is, I think that he thought, like, this guy may not know something, but he's already in. There's no going back at this point. And I think that was more of a frustration thing, because it's like, I'm doing everything I can to get this person to admit it, and they're not admitting it. So maybe they don't know anything. And that was him just taking it out. But then it was just, I think the rest of it was more or less, it was like, hey, even if there's a 1% chance, it doesn't matter at this point, I'm screwed. And I might as well take it all the way, because no matter what, I'm screwed. But if I can maybe get some information on the daughter, and he does, you know what I mean? It's like, it's worth it.
Yeah, I mean, and we see that juxtaposed to Loki doing actual police work, right? He's just running down leads. Like, we see the thing where he runs down pedophiles and he ends up at this, you know, retired priest's house, and he goes and digs in the basement and he finds this body, you know, and the priest tells him, oh, this guy confessed to killing children, so I had to kill him. And he's like, yeah, right, you know, whatever. And he blows it off. But then he goes to the secondhand store, and the checkout girl's like, yeah, this weird guy's always buying children's clothes, but he never has any kids with him. And, you know, he's always paying cash. And so you're waiting for that lead to surmise. And there's all these little things going on, and you're watching Loki just try to keep Dover sane, and he has no idea what's really going on. And then to try to figure out what's going on, and he has no idea where Alex is. And then he starts to get suspicious of Dover, because he's like, why is this dude creeping out at this, like, abandoned building? And, like, that confrontation they have in the parking lot outside the liquor store, man, that's some good acting, like, in a small space. Like, those two guys go at each other for a good 6 minutes, and it's some incredible dialogue.
Well, the thing that got me too, and I don't know where you land on here, so I'll ask you, is when Jake Gyllenhaal's interest is kind of turning away from the girls and onto where Alex is, and, you know, he's looking at Keller. did you want him to find out what he was doing, or did you want it to just like, did you have such an understanding of what he was doing that you wanted him to get away with it?
I think, did I understand what Keller was doing? I wanted him to get away with it, or did I want Loki to get on his track? Cause I'll tell you right now, I was on team Loki the minute Gyllenhaal started doing cop stuff in this movie. I was totally in his zone, and I didn't look at it so much as he was going away from the girls as he realized I don't have anything more on that right now, but this dude's acting weird and like weirder than he should be right now for what's going on with him. And I've got his best friend over here who's falling apart, which is what he ought to be doing. His wife is drugged up in bed. He's not even talking to her. What is this dude doing? You know, there's something going on. And when he starts to research and he finds out his father killed himself and there's that building, he's like, this just doesn't add up. Like, and if you're a suspicious cop character, you get suspicious and you go and figure out why you're suspicious. And so I liked it. I thought it was cool. And I liked the fact that he's going to keep an eye on that while keeping another eye on something else. Cause the thing I got about Loki, cause we never see him do it in this, I don't think the dude sleeps, man. I think he like power naps for 30 minutes and slams two Red Bulls and goes, you know, like this, just, that's just how he is. And you see it on his face and the way that they dress him, and he just gets more tired and more exhausted. But when he's got to turn it on, man, those eyes, like, Gyllenhaal's got great eyes and just lights him up. You know, it's so cool. But I was on his side the whole way, and I wanted him to find out what Dover was doing, because for a minute, I was like, you know what? He's got such a past that like, he's not a parent and all that stuff, but he's going to understand, like, I know how you got here, and I will help you as much as I can, but I need you to, you know, trust me. And the truth is that Dover is never going to trust him or anybody in the system. And that's the lesson that they both learn.
Yeah. For me, I'm actually on the opposite side of the fence there. It was more or less like, I kind of hoped that he wasn't going to get caught. And I don't know. It's weird. I'm very much someone who analyzes dreams a lot. And I've had a lot of dreams where, and to anybody listening to this, I'm not a criminal. Never done anything crazy.
Like, you know, nothing here is an admission or an actionable item.
It's not. But I've had those dreams where I've committed a crime and where the police are on to me. And just that feeling of like, Oh crap. Almost at the end of the dream where you're going, this has got to be a dream. It's got to be a dream. And then you wake up and you go, oh my God, thank God that was a dream, because that felt so real. I was getting flashbacks of that watching this.
Yeah.
I completely understood his character. And it was like, again, I'm like, I get where this guy's at. I don't want to see him go away. Cause I'm like, I'm not even thinking of him at that point. I'm thinking of his older son. I'm thinking of his wife. And I'm like, my God, you know, their daughter's probably dead. And now this guy is literally going to go away for the rest of his life. Like, they are, if they this is not going to be something where they're like, well, we get it. Like, no, what he did there means that he's not seeing the light of day until he's at least in his 70s. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know that there's going to be consequences for it, but they give us this great middle misdirect. And I thought of more recent movie that did this. Gone Girl does this too, you know, especially when it twists on itself. But there's a lot of misdirects in that movie, and some of it happens around like a night vigil and stuff. And so when the Bob character shows up and is like laying a little bunny thing or whatever down by one of the candles, and Loki's just looking at him, and they lock eyes and he takes off. I had flashbacks to like Gone Girl, but also another Fincher flick, Seven. Remember when Brad Pitt just happens to stumble into the right apartment hallway, and there comes John Doe, and all of a sudden they just take off and have that great chase scene in the rain. I was like, yeah, man. Like, oh, wow. So that to me was a great moment in the movie, because I thought, you've now blown it for us. We know Alex isn't involved in it. Who the hell is that? And you know, what's going on, and how are we going to find that person? And the way that all runs down, man, I was on board for that. Even if I felt like it was a little rushed and the way that he ultimately found him and showed up at his front door.
Well, they always say, you know, criminals return to the scene of the crime. Right. And, you know, the way he was like going up there and kind of touching the teddy bear and everything. But what did you think when he got into his, actually the house, And then they got all those, basically those pelican cases.
Oh, with the snakes in them? Oh, see, man, see, I'm Indiana Jones. Like, why do they have to be snakes, man? Like, I do not. I run a lot outside. If I see a snake, I'm like, nope, we're turning around. That's Nope Ropes Road right there. We're not doing that. And so I don't do the slitherings. And when he started doing that, man, I was like, oh, no, don't tell me there's going to be like one of these kids buried under a pile of snakes or some shit, you know, because that's just what I thought. And what you realize is that, here's the thing, though, Bob's also not in on this. Bob is just... He just, for some reason, Holly and her husband didn't kill Alex and Bob, maybe because Alex got hurt with the snake and maybe because Bob saw it or was already screwed up anyway. And they just felt like, well, if we kill them, that's awful. So we'll take normal kids and kill them. Like, that makes it any better. Right. But I'm trying to think the way that, you know, these two people that are having a war on God think. And I don't know. I just thought it was wild. Cause I mean, again, you don't cast this dude unless you want him to play somebody sinister looking. I mean, he looks, it just has a look to him. He's kind of like, John Caviezel, you know, remember him? Mm-hmm. And it just has that look, and you're like, he could only be certain things. And I don't know. He was so creepy. And when they bring him in the interrogation and he's drawing those mazes and stuff, and he's like muttering to himself, I'm like, man, and you see Loki losing his mind about it because he just is getting so frustrated. I'm like, this is about to go real bad. And I did not see him pulling the gun and shooting himself, though. I'll be honest with you. I did not see that as his end. But, man, is it a striking moment.
Yeah, and then after that, then they're going through all the possessions there. And, you know, they got the girl's clothes in there. And there's blood on it and everything like that. And you think, like, you know, when they go out crying, at that moment, I thought, like, yeah, they're dead. You know what I mean?
Right.
This is now going to be about, you know, Keller and Alex. And that's what this is going to turn into. That it's basically, it's like the girls being taken away was the basically not the real plot of it. The plot is what someone does, you know, when put in that circumstance and how, you know, what happens there. So, yeah, it was definitely, I thought they were dead. What about you?
I did too. I really did until I caught something where Keller says, my wife's not coming. And when Loki says, well, if you can't identify anything, she's going to have to come down here and look. You need to know they've already found clothing or whatever. And the way Hugh Jackman, like those first four or five photographs, and it's, I mean, this is like good filmmaking because a less adept filmmaker is going to like blow through this. And they just slow the movie down. Just one picture, two pictures, three pictures. And when they get to the picture of that sock and he like cocks his head, Hugh Jackman does a certain way, and he just starts blubbering. You're like, oh man, no, are they dead? And I thought, man, if they are dead, what is, because I knew how much longer was left in this movie. I was like, what the hell are they gonna do for the next 40 minutes? Like, there's gotta be, it can't be him on the run the whole time, right? And when he goes back to the house and he has that argument with his son, you know, where his son is like, they're dead, you need to let it go. And he says, we never give up on anybody until we absolutely have to. I was like, he doesn't believe it. He still thinks there's something there. And I thought, well, the movie's not going to let that happen and then yank that from out from under him, because this dude is beyond nothing left to lose at this point. So I wasn't sure. And then at that point, I'm like, okay, they're not dead. And then, I mean, they solve it pretty quick for you because Joy comes running out, you know, not long after that. And it's like, oh shit, one of them's alive. So, you know, he's right. And I'll credit the movie for not stringing that out for too long and leaving us in the dark by letting us know, like, he's right, they're alive, but can they beat the clock?
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing too about the scene there where he's going through the pictures and everything like that is, you know, you think of any like traumatic something that's happening in your life, like, let's say, you know, I'm sure you've had people, you know, die, right? And when you find out that news, you know what I mean? And it's like when someone's like trying to like actually going to tell you that, and how like that adrenaline pumps, but everything slows down. You know what I mean? As much as like everything, your body's going fast, your pulse is going fast, your blood pressure is going up. And, you know, think about even like with a job, you know, have you ever been fired from a job and you know, you're going into that meeting and you know what they're going to be saying, mm-hmm. and you're just kind of like, everything slows down, but in reality it's probably a lot quicker. But that's what that was really good about. That was just the whole fact of like, he's taking it in because he's got no other choice.
Right. And it's the perception of it too. When he shows up in the hospital and he sees Joy, like, and Keller becomes this cop, you know, all of a sudden he's asking her questions and they're like, hey bro, it's like, let's chill out a little bit. And you see why he's desperate and they let it go. And then he realizes, wait a minute, the real cops are here. oh, they're going to figure out like something's up, you know, or whatever. I got to go and figure out what to do now. And the way he gets out of that hospital and runs away again, it's another moment to let you know, like, this is a police force, but there's not that many of them and they don't have all the resources in the world. They can't just block the, you know, they're calling downstairs to the, you know, security at hospital and they can't stop him from getting out, you know? And so he slips through their fingers again. And you realize then, like, Loki knows then at that point, like, I know where he's going. He's going back to that place. And that's what leads him back to, you know, where they ultimately find Alex. And, but you wonder, what's Dover going to do at this point? Where's he go? And when he shows up at Holly's front door, at first I didn't recognize who that actor was. And then I realized, wait a minute, that's Melissa Leo. Melissa Leo's not doing a nothing part. Something's up. And I didn't know how she was involved in this. Like, maybe she's just covering up for him or whatever. When he shows up at her house the first time, I was like, something bad's about to happen. When he goes back the second time, I'm like, oh yeah, he's screwed. Like, it's obviously, this is over. Wait, did you know that? Or when did you figure out that she was definitely involved?
When he went back the second time, I think they had to give it up at that point. As far as it, both her, like, she was such a, again, like another meek character, you know, purposely done where it's like,
yeah, but weird though, man. She was kind of a weirdo, like the whole time too.
In retrospect, she was, but when you consider everything else that's going on,
I mean, true, yeah,
yeah. It doesn't stick out on you on the first viewing, but on the second viewing, it's like, okay, you're kind of seeing some of this stuff. You're kind of seeing some of the tells and everything. But the first viewing, you're not really going to notice it with her. But yeah, then it turned into the whole, like, you know, drink the purple juice with her and all that, and you know, pretty crazy stuff there, but.
Yeah, so that's what I want to get to is what do you make of what the ultimate reveal of all of this is, and like the motivation, and really what I call the fast forward ending of this is that it was her and her husband, revenge for their kid dying, and they took these other two kids and let them live, but then they started killing all these other ones, and they have this Trans Am in the backyard nobody bothers to ever look at, and that's where they hide people and all of that. I'll be honest, man, like, It felt a little James Bond villainy that she was just gonna like tell him all that shit all of a sudden. I'm like, why would you? I know you need to do it for the plot purposes and like the movie's purposes, but this person, if they've killed as many people as they claim to have killed, she would just blow this dude away, you know, and nobody would care because he's on the run anyway, right? You know, she doesn't know that at that point, but she apparently can get away with murder pretty well. So I don't know. I just felt that was kind of strange that she felt the need to tell him everything while he's, you're being thrown in a hole.
I think because he had figured it out, I think she knew that the gig was up. You know what I mean? It was only a matter of time before the other police then put two and two together. And I think that's kind of when it was just like, nah, you know, I'll sit here and I'll do the villain monologue and tell everybody, you know, and tell you in the audience, but also the audience needs to know at that point, because you know what I mean? They're not going to have a 20-minute thing at the end with Loki sitting there and explaining what the motivations were and everything. It was
like being a psycho.
Yeah. It had to be told. And that's the whole thing is like, I think you got to give the movie that because the audience deserves answers. And the entire point of the movie is not even about that. You know what I mean? That is just the, It's the movie's not about the kidnapping as much as it is about each of these individual characters and other parts of themselves.
The prisoners of the situations that they've created for themselves. You know, her and her husband created this situation where they were gonna be the monsters. You know, and they said, you know, if bad things happen to enough people, you create your own monsters, and that's what they kind of did with Bob and Alex, you know, and they just weren't functioning enough to like survive and continue the legacy, right? And then look at what she did to Dover. She turned him into a complete maniac, you know, and all this stuff. So she knew what she was doing, and I'm with you. I feel like in some ways the movie earned the fact that she needed to do that big monologue and explanation, but it was also like, we're down to the last 20 minutes here. We got to wrap this stuff up. And so it felt a little rushed and convenient, but I guess at that point I was with the movie, so I didn't mind it. It's only like sitting here picking it apart and thinking about it that I'm going like, I don't know, is that too convenient, you know, or whatever. But in the moment,
it's like the oxygen check at the end of Jaws. You know what I mean?
If the movie's earned it, I'll go with it. Right. Yeah. So, which, you know, was eventually argued, it wouldn't, and Spielberg said no, they will at that point, and as it turned out, Spielberg was right, as he generally is when he does stuff like that. Not always, but generally. And I felt like this was good. And I like that she threw him in that hole. And I love what she says to him, like, you tie a tourniquet, you might live long enough for me to throw your daughter's body down there for you to see her. And I was like, man, what a cold ass thing to say to somebody, you know, especially this dude who's just completely broken at that point. And what I loved about it was how Jackman, instead of beating his fists against the plywood and all that stuff, like, just crawls around in the dark and starts saying a prayer, like, and he's not even praying for himself. You know, it's like, just please protect my daughter. She's still alive. Please just let her live. And he doesn't even care about himself. And it's like, that's his moment of redemption, even though he's definitely going to prison because when they find him and all this stuff, we'll get to that in a second. But he realizes, I've gone too far. So if this is my fate, fine, but please let my daughter live. And it's when you realize that all the rage and anger and mistrust and all the shit that this guy has and all his baggage, it all starts from his love for his kid, you know, and it is that he went to the most extreme thing. And if she can just live, it would be worth it for him. And I just thought that was a great moment and a great little piece of acting by him while he's kind of playing with that little whistle in the dirt.
And I had a little bit of a different take on it. So, you know, we talk about like the torture of Alex and everything like that. And I brought up the whole thing when he started slamming the hammer into the sink and everything. And I think how we knew kind of like, this guy didn't do it. I think that the rest of the torture of Alex was not so much for getting information about the daughter. It was because he was angry and he was going to take this out on somebody. And you know what? He's already doing it on him. There's no going back. And that's what it was. And I think that when he went down in the hole, he had that revelation about like, the actions that I did have put me into this position now. And that's when I think he was finally repenting and just being like, this whole thing has been about my daughter. Just please protect her. You know, he realized mm-hmm. like, I screwed up. What I did there led this to me, but it didn't fix anything. But yeah. Please just, you know, he's giving his faith to someone else and just saying, fix this, because I have only done, the only thing I've done is mess this up.
Yeah. It's that ultimately emptying. And that's what repentance really is that turning away from the thing you're doing to try to control what is not in your control. And as you know, as this character is a person of faith, and we've established that throughout the movie and things, he's come back to it having wandered and tried to fix it himself and realizing that I can't. And I just need one last thing to save her, and if I die, then I die, you know, and that's it. And what's neat is when Loki pulls up, I'm like, man, what is he going to find? And the way, again, it's part of that good face acting for Gyllenhaal. When he gets that picture and he looks at it, the way his eyes bug out, it's like he turns into, like, he's half asleep and he's like, wait a minute, I better wake up. And he's got that gun. He goes like total Clarice Starling at the end of Silence of the Lambs through that house. And I love that. I mean, I expected the lights to go out at one moment, you know, to do that. And I thought that showdown with Melissa Leo, when he catches her, you know, and she's like, just make sure they cremate me. I don't want to be buried in a box. I was like, oh shit. I mean, that was wild the way that went down.
And I think that kind of adds more to my, you know, thoughts about, she knew the gig was up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, she was poisoning the girl at that point, right?
Yeah, she's poisoning the girl to do that, kind of throw it in the hole there, and then basically, you know, accept what's going to be coming to her. But yeah, I mean, she definitely does get what's coming to her. You know what I mean? Yep. She gets one right in the head, and then you got the next scene, because you know, Loki is you know, he's injured, and he rushes the daughter to you know, the emergency room and everything like that. And it's me, you know, as someone myself who suffers from panic attacks, is something that I deal with. It's very, very weird about how that scene was shot, because it's very, very similar. Mm-hmm. If you ever have had an anxiety or panic attack, about how things are just, you're hyper-focused, but then you feel like you're losing control. And then just the way everything kind of is around there, it was very well done.
Oh yeah. I mean, it is a perfect adrenaline rush chase scene, action scene in a movie that doesn't really need that, but then they get it. And I put a lot, and Deakins was nominated for the Academy Award, and goodness gracious, he should have won it for this. But the way he shot that, and I mean, it's like the worst conditions ever. It's friggin' snowing. There's, you know, there's holiday traffic, because this is a week after Thanksgiving. So we're in shopping season now, man. Everybody's out on the weekend. You know, it's starting to be bad weather. And this guy's been grazed in the head. So his eyes like clotting up. He can't half see. And he's trying to talk this girl and keep her awake so he can get her to the emergency room. And the fact that he weaves in and out all that traffic, there's not one single accident. I'm like, that is a miracle in and of itself. Like, it really is. But that's, I think that's something that this movie is showing us, the physical representation of Keller's prayer being answered. Cause how else can you possibly explain how that happens? You know, you can't, you know, and I think that's what makes it neat. And it's a great scene. And I love how they, I mean, he just runs in there's like, help. And then boom, cut. And you realize like she's alive and he's alive and all of this. And, you know, when we see her come in again with her mom and she's got that new whistle and she talks about how they found it right before Joy got away. But, you know, I just bought her a new one, but she says it's the same one. There's like this whole thing on the internet. And I was amazed by this, that people think like it was a magical whistle that Keller found in the hole. I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure that's his daughter's whistle. And like, they just bought her another one. Like, I didn't really get confused by that. Did you?
No. The whistle in the hole was hers, because they obviously went back to the house. They ended up finding the whistle. Then they ended up getting kidnapped in the RV, and then she left it in there. And, you know, when she found the hole, and yeah, that's what it was. And it's, you know, kind of the whole thing about what ended up taking them away at the end is probably what ended up saving his life. Cause, you know, as Loki and everything is, you know, they're looking around the house and they're doing forensics there and stuff. You know, he's about to walk away and then he hears the whistle.
I mean, what's wild about it is that like, it's at least been a couple of days at this point. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and this guy is under the ground freezing, you know, I mean, bleeding and who knows what all right. And the forensic guys don't hear nothing, you know, but again, you look at them and I'm like, well, you know what, man, they're like digging in the ground. They got headphones on. They got on all their gear. They're probably trying not to freeze their ass off out there. They're worried about, you know, processing something 20 feet away. And Loki hears it and he kind of goes like, nah. And then you hear it again. And he turns around like just that quick jerk of his neck. I was like, man, that's good acting. And then just the smash cut to the title screen. I was like, that was slick. That was really well done to leave us with, oh, did he find him? And I'm like, I think it's obvious he found him, right? Like, I don't think there's any doubt. Like, he found him, and Keller Dover is in prison, but he's alive and his kid's alive.
Yeah, and if you read anything about the ending, the actual ending was even further. He did find him. He ended up pulling the car apart and then going down there and looking down there, and he was in the hole alive. So yes, the director even said, yeah, they did find him, but now he's got the consequences of what he did to live with now.
Yeah. And I mean, it's what a, you know, twisting tale, but was it enough for us to give it high marks? We'll see. It's time for final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings. So Nick, what are yours for Prisoners?
For me, I gave it extra large popcorn. I think this is a great first movie for this retrospective. And it's one that I got done watching and just, you know, I recommended to a lot of people. I'm like, you got to see this movie. I know it's 10 years old. It's something that, you know, I think some people have kind of, like you said, have kind of known about, but really have never watched. And it's just a movie that I thought was just, you know, solid from beginning to end. It's one I want to watch again. And just to be able to kind of see kind of how these things add up, you know, you do like kind of a one-time watch. And, you know, you're like, good, it's good. And then there's ones that you watch and you go, yeah, maybe I'll go revisit it later. This is one of the few movies where I've watched where I'm like, I want to watch it again right away. I don't think I've really had that since, like, you know, something like Mad Max Fury Road or something, where I'm like, there's so much density to, you know, the movie's so dense that I want to go back and revisit it right away, just because knowing what happens is almost just as rewarding as watching it the first time, because now you're able to put the pieces together and really see how well crafted it was. So definitely an extra large popcorn, really enjoyed the movie, and just strong all around.
It's a movie a lot like Seven or The Usual Suspects. You know, once you know the mystery, the thing that gets you to go back to those is watching it unravel and watching how you get misled as the audience, how the protagonists get misled, how they get down the road they go, and then just getting into things like the atmosphere and the cinematography and, you know, the acting and all that stuff. And this movie is in that same vein, but I'm going to compare it to something that I told you I was going to do this, but I didn't tell you what it was. This reminded me of a 1979 thriller that's near and dear to my heart, and it's in the archives, but it's not a great movie. But it reminded me a lot of When a Stranger Calls from 1979. The first act of that movie was the movie, and then they stretched it into a full length because the short, you know, got them the deal to do the big one. But the first act of that movie is all tension. And I mean, it'll just chill you if you've ever seen it. I mean, it's the Have You Checked the Children? It's something that's from a bygone era because it's a world we don't live in anymore. But yeah, I mean, it is a chilling, chilling piece of cinematography with music. And it's one person really doing all the acting and then the voice actor on the phone. But it's so good. But then the second act of that movie just goes all over the damn place. And you're just like meandering wondering, watching Charles Durning do police work, and there's just a lot of talking, and you don't know what's going on, and you meet the killer, and you don't know what his deal is, and they try to make him sympathetic, which was a bad idea. And then the third act takes off like a shot, but it gets to an ending where you feel like, yeah, that's the ending I wanted. And when I was watching this movie, it hit me that I'm like, I wonder if Denny has seen that and liked that movie in some way, because this movie feels so much like that. It's much better story and acted and paced, but it's got the same kind of beats. And for that reason, and for the same reason I go back and will watch When a Stranger Calls every now and then, this one's definitely one that's getting put on the repeat watch and stuff. I do have some nitpicks with it. I do think sometimes it gets a little convenient with itself. I do think we kind of dump the Franklin character somewhere in the movie here. And then once his daughter's released, like, he's just out of the movie for some reason. And I don't know if there's stuff on the cutting room floor or not. I don't necessarily want the movie to be longer, but I kind of felt like he just left and almost like Viola Davis took his role. And I would rather see more of her. I felt like Maria Bella just kind of goes to bed and then wakes up. And maybe that was all she was asked to do, but I wanted more of that. And I could almost see, like, man, if this was like 8 episodes of like a limited run thing or something, it could really stretch itself out. So it's not perfect, but it is really, really strong. And it's one of the best thrillers of the last decade, no doubt. I'm glad I finally tore the bandage off and watched it. So I'm going to give it a strong, large popcorn with extra butter. I think it's really good and is a neat way to start this retrospective, because we'll get some more thriller motif and noir motif with this director before we get into some of the bigger sci-fi stuff that he's got in his repertoire as well. But always a good time to talk about these things, and glad we got to talk about Prisoners today.
Yeah, next week, our next show, will be revisiting this director and Jake Gyllenhaal when we're going to do the movie Enemy. Actually came out the same year. So
yeah,
definitely will be interesting. A little bit of a sneak peek. I have seen it. I've watched it before we talk here, and definitely going to be a different discussion as far as, you know, this one being a thriller, and this one is definitely a very, very different movie. So going to be looking forward to talking that with you.
Yeah, I've never seen that one, so I'm looking forward to delving into that, but I understand it's quite a different film, and so it'll be fun to get into. Folks, of course, you can follow this show at filmstrippodcast.com or the show's social media at filmstrippod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the places where you can find us. You'll get announcements about upcoming shows and a link to our Letterboxd page, which has our entire list of reviews. Of course, if you just go through our archive section, you know, 300-plus episodes back, we've got a little bit of something for everybody. We've name-dropped a few of them here. Search through, and you can find something everywhere you can find podcasts: Apple, Spotify, Google. We are there. Please share the show on your social media. Leave us a positive review. It helps other people find the show, and let us know what you think of the podcast. We appreciate the support. For Nick, I'm Jay. Thanks for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504(c)(2), Title 17.